This is Hit Bull Win Podcast, the official podcast of the Durham Bulls, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network. I'm Scott Strickland, Assistant GM of the Durham Bulls. Welcome back, Bulls fans, to Hit Bull Win Podcast. We got another great episode in front of us. He's got a face for radio, that's for sure. But he's developed into, not trying to pump him up too much here, but he's developed into one of the top guys at ESPN, calling a lot of sporting events that many of us have watched and probably listened to. And he's got some humble backgrounds in minor league baseball. I mean, I guess technically, to a degree, he was my first boss, one of my first bosses, which...
of course I was.
We'll blame my professional development on you, or lack thereof. But welcome, Tom Hart, to the broadcast. Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. What an original name for the podcast. How long did it take you to come up with that? You just looked right out the window and you saw it on the wall and thought, right, why not?
Yeah.
No podcast in the title, we're good to go.
Absolutely. You know, don't try to reinvent the wheel, right?
Right. That's... Sometimes there's a saying for this. I don't know what it is. But sometimes the most obvious answer is the one right in front of you.
Yeah. I like to think that minor league baseball does a great job of just completely copying what somebody else does. And so, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So
don't even try.
Absolutely. Well, cool. Again, welcome to our podcast. I think this will be fun. You've got a cool background. You're doing some cool stuff now. And then also we'll kind of touch on professional sports attempting to come back right now. And I don't know, kind of an interesting perspective of what the broadcast community, kind of the hurdles they're going to have in front of them as we get going. But first, how are you and your family doing, and how has COVID-19 kind of impacted your daily life? I'm sure it's kind of turned it upside down, but yeah, from your perspective and broadcaster's perspective, how has all this impacted the daily routine?
Well, we're doing great. My wife and three kids and I just chilling in the abode in Atlanta. I got the phone call on March 14th, I forget what it was. I was in Nashville calling the SEC men's basketball tournament, and we called two games that Wednesday night. And then that Thursday, I just left Kentucky's practice and was doing a radio show at the Omni Hotel. And ironically enough, or coincidentally enough, I suppose, in a ballroom immediately adjacent, right next door. In fact, I believe it was one of those ballrooms that you could fold back the wall if you had a really, really big party. So through that wall sat all of the SEC presidents and the commissioner, and I'm sorry, I don't think the presidents were all there, but all the ADs were there. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's some people on the phone, and they were talking through what eventually would be the cancellation of the SEC tournament. And then everything else hit the fan the rest of that day. So since that day, instead of finishing out the SEC tournament, flying to Seattle to do an XFL game and finishing my XFL schedule, which would have dovetailed with my college baseball schedule all the way into Omaha until the Saturday we just passed. Instead of doing all that stuff, I've been home, and it's been great. I mean, I haven't been home this much in for this long a stretch in the entire length of my marriage, let alone my fatherhood. So it's been really cool just hanging with the family and, you know, spending time around each other. And we've got enough room that we can go hide from each other if our nerves get a little frayed, which I think is important. But otherwise, we're just we're pushing through, and we've got nothing to complain about.
What's been the coolest part of what you just described, being home more and not having to be on the road as much as I would love to see your frequent flyer miles. Like my public school education probably could not count that high, but yeah, I mean, what's the best thing you've gained from this?
You know, just being present. I love my job. I love what I'm able to do. I get a kick out of it no matter where I'm going, whether it's the College World Series or a random game on a Tuesday night where the visibility is going to be relatively small, given the scope of what I do. So, you know, what the hardest thing that I do is roll the suitcase through the kitchen on a school morning and head to the airport with the kids eating breakfast. And they go, you're leaving again. Like, that's hard, mm-hmm. even though I love what I do. And I love the fact that, and consider myself lucky to. So the fact that I haven't had to do that has been fantastic. Now, I miss being around the people that I work with and the personalities that I get to interact with on a regular basis. So just being present and being part of family life for an extended period with no interruptions, it sounds weird to say, but it's new to me. So I love every bit of that. And it could be, you know, it could be a family outing where we're going on a hike or a walk on the nature path. Or it could be, you know, having a cold beer in the driveway while the kids ride scooters up and down and hit tennis balls against the garage door. It doesn't have to be anything big. We watched all the Harry Potter movies.
Yep.
So that was a regular occurrence here till we powered through those. And we've eaten a lot more dinners. You know, our TV, I put it this way. Our TV is rarely on, which is a big change of pace. Especially because there are no sports for me to be watching at 8 o'clock every weeknight or every weekend when I do happen to be home. But when it is on, it's something that we're doing together and we're eating meals, you know, around the coffee table and watching something together. So a lot of shared experiences.
Do you ever throw in a reel tape to like, Hey, I got a great movie night tonight, fam. Let's go watch myself.
You know, this run up to the College World Series, they've been replaying some games on ESPNU and whatnot. And I flipped over the other day because I wanted to see, I couldn't remember who I was doing this particular game with. So I thought, I saw it was on. Let me flip over. And my youngest daughter walks through and she says, "Oh, Daddy, that's you." And I started to explain. I said, "Yeah, this was the regional in Louisville, between Louisville and Oklahoma, and Kyler Murray ended up going in the first round, and then he gets drafted in the NFL. It's a crazy thing." And I turn back and look, she's out of the room and up the stairs. Like, no, she doesn't care. She's like, "Oh, Daddy, it's you." And then footsteps. Like, that's as far as we get.
She's off to play with frozen dolls or something.
Yeah. She's got a lot better things to do than worry about Kyler Murray and if he only pinch ran in an entire NCAA regional. Then he get drafted in the top 10.
Kind of merging into your professional life here. So you're a Missouri guy, big Mizzou guy. You're a good Twitter follow for all the folks who on the Twitter sphere. Give T Hart a follow here. But talk to me about. And this is I'm not familiar with this. I'm not familiar with what you did kind of at Missouri to help prepare yourself for your professional career. That's one of our kind of the initial purpose of this podcast was to give a behind the curtain peek into what it's like to work and run a minor league baseball team and then throw in some cool interviews and roll a podcast out. And obviously that's kind of changed a little bit, DC during COVID. But for any, you know, future, aspiring broadcaster, kind of what did you do there in that college time frame and then immediately after to prepare yourself for what you're doing today?
I did absolutely nothing to prepare myself for this. So there's always hope. If you are an average student who spends more time, I was at the bars. Now I was bartending. That's how I paid for my school. So I
sure
just want to throw that out there. I didn't have much progress towards my professional career while I was in school, even though Missouri has one of the best journalism schools in the country. So I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do and how to get there. Now, this is the mid to late 90s. It seems like in this day and age, there's a lot of different places you can go to school to learn to be a play-by-play broadcaster and get reps to be a play-by-play announcer. When I was in school, it was more like you want to sit behind the desk and be an anchor. No, I want to be at the games. I want to call the games. Oh, well, we have a campus television station and you can learn how to report and anchor. No, I don't want to do that. I don't care about that. So I just kind of had to slice through the woods with my own machete and talk my way into the business in minor league baseball, oddly enough, since I'm on this podcast, turned out to be the best route to do it. I pulled off two big heists early on to get me where I needed to be. Number one was I'd moved from Columbia, Missouri to Columbia, South Carolina, just to have a summer away with my best friend at the time. His brother is in politics and was working in state capital, South Carolina. So we moved into the extra room for a summer. We worked at Applebee's during the day, and I talked myself into the broadcast booth at Capital City Stadium at night with a gentleman by the name of Mark Bryant. And Mark was kind enough to allow me to show up one day. He didn't know I was going to stick around, but the first night I went, and I got him on the phone, explained I'd love an internship. He said, we don't have room. I actually have two interns, highly sought after. We don't do that. So I pivoted and said, well, I just want to shadow you. Surely you'll let me shadow you for a night. And I twisted his arm enough. He allowed me to come by. They were playing the Greensboro Bats that night. And Evan Marler was the radio announcer for Greens. I messed that up. Evan in Greensboro at the time? I think he might have been in Hickory. Anyway, they were playing the Greensboro Bats that night, and there was a downpour. Huge thunderstorm comes through, lasts most of the night. I arrived at about 4 o'clock that afternoon. I stayed through the game being banged, which was at, you know, probably like 8:30. So the employees make their way back to the office. I tag along. I say to Mark, thank you for allowing me to come. I didn't really get to see anything, you know, because there was no game, but I did have a chance to bend the ear of the other radio announcer and learn a little bit about the industry. I said, so, you know, I'd love to come back tomorrow and actually see you work. He said, well, of course. Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I go back the next night. Banged again.
Oh gosh.
Another like, I hope it's 3 not a weekend. Hour delay. Huge thunderstorms. I'm pretty sure it was a week night because I was working lunches at Applebee's.
Okay.
For spending cash. And I looked at him, I said, you know, hey, deja vu all over again. I didn't learn a thing. You didn't call a single pitch. I guess I'll see you tomorrow. Reluctantly, he's like, I mean, sure. And I said, well, hey, the whole idea is for me to job shadow you.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen any action.
Have you pulled tarp yet?
So I did not. I would have been more than happy to, but I didn't want to push my luck. So I come back the next night. Now there's a different opponent in town. Now the Hickory Crawdads are in town, if I'm not mistaken. And you won't believe what happened. Another rainout. So I leave that night, give him the wave. Hey, see you tomorrow. Now I'm practically an employee. Come back the next night for a doubleheader. I sit in his radio booth for a little while. I sit in the opponent's radio booth. And I learn, you know, two things. A, I could do this. B, I've got a lot of learning to do if this is what I want to try and do. So I spent, you know, half of the summer there. And then in that off season, convinced them to give me a job as an intern for the summer of 1998, which they won the South Atlantic League Championship, by the way. And I spent that entire summer calling all of the road games. Mm-hmm. I got paid, I think I made $50 a game for home games to run the scoreboard, which was big money.
Yeah, big.
I got paid less when I got the opportunity to PA, which never made much sense to me.
You're probably able to quit the gig at Applebee's with that, right?
I couldn't stick at Applebee's because I was doing all the road games. For road games at the time, the employee per diem was $20 a day.
Okay.
I convinced the GM to bump me to the staff per diem, which was $25 a day. So, you know, 140 game season over 100 and probably 50 something days, right? So I made an average of $35 a day,
mm-hmm.
and was paying rent and paying gas and, you know, good for my diet, eating at the ballpark every night.
Yeah.
But that's how I got into the business. And what I loved about being on the air every night in minor league baseball, and that's really the only place you can get it with and I had zero experience, zero. The biggest benefit is you're going to screw up, but you get a chance to improve every night. Mm-hmm. So whatever mistake you made Tuesday night, you have a chance to fix on Wednesday night. And if you don't fix that mistake, then you're not going anywhere. But if you're able to fix those mistakes night after night, and then you get as your own best critic, if you're able to then fix mistakes, not night to night or game to game, but then inning by inning, and then out to out, and then pitch to pitch, and then you've developed a filter where you don't even make those mistakes and you can get consistency, then you have a chance to make strides. But that wouldn't have, that's really not possible. In other aspects, yeah, of broadcasting, like I needed those reps. I needed 140 games a year because I was raw. I had nothing. So learning that helped me out big time. I wouldn't be where I am today without those opportunities.
How did you get the Winston job? So you go to Winston, what, 99 the following year?
So I went to Winston-Salem in 1999. They had a broadcaster by the name of Tim Grubbs. And
Tim Grubbs.
Tim Grubbs. Tim is, and last I checked, he's still in the business. The New Orleans team, I think, moved to Wichita. Tim was, anyway, he jumped a couple levels once I got to know him. But the contacts that I made those first two nights at the ballpark, the radio announcer from Greensboro and the radio announcer from Hickory, were two guys that I stayed in touch with over the course of that season, the off season. And then, of course, I made contacts my summer 98 when I was doing the games on my own, the road games at least. And those guys told me about a job opening in Winston-Salem because Don Beaver owned, mm-hmm, the team in Winston-Salem, also owned the team in Knoxville, also owned the team in New Orleans. And some other guys had left, and there was a reverse domino effect. So Tim Grubbs took the Winston-Salem job, and I went to the winter meetings in Nashville that year. And I did not interview for the job at the winter meetings. I found out about the job opening at the winter meetings. I put my resume under the GM's door, a gentleman by the name of Pete Fish, who you work for as well. And I talked to Pete on the phone one time, but I couldn't crack through. So that was in mid-December, I'm guessing. And I think it was early January. I called Pete up and I said, hey, I'm going to be in your neck of the woods. I'm giving my buddy a ride home from school. Can I stop by and talk to you about the job? And it turned into a face-to-face interview. So I get in the car, and part of that was true. I was in his neighborhood, but I was coming to his neighborhood from Columbia, Missouri to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, on my way to drop off a buddy because he was too cheap to buy a plane ticket down in South Carolina. So I didn't tell Pete that part of the story for maybe a year, but I paid my freight. I drove my own way down to Columbia, South Carolina, dropped my buddy off, hooked it up to Winston-Salem, had an interview, and bothered him till he gave me a job.
That's awesome. As the Budweiser clock,
nice,
from your old booth sits over my right shoulder right now, I'll let you take this because you're better with words. But that press box in Winston-Salem at the affectionately called Big Earn, aka Ernie Shore Field, built in 1956. Or open in 1956. How would you describe to our listeners the structural integrity of that quote unquote press box?
The press box had the structural integrity of a cardboard box that had been left out in the rain. Picture, if you will, Tiger Stadium, Detroit's Tiger Stadium, which is now, you know, obviously been replaced years ago by Comerica, but you got a big roof behind the behind home plate that covers the grandstand. And on top of that roof is a plywood box about the size of a shipping container. And on the front end of that box, well, let's start with the back. On the back end of that box, which sits on a tar and gravel roof, there is a broken set of stairs
on cinder blocks
that eventually turned into just a cinder block. But to even get to the stairs, you had to walk up two cross sections of ramp that were accessed by a metal stairs at the far end of the brick building, which also sat underneath this roof. The box itself, like the size of a shipping container, so on the front end facing the field were four large holes for windows. They had swinging plywood covers that would hook into the ceiling that you would unhook on your way out, and then affix them to the wall to ostensibly keep them from blowing open. What damage could have been done when they, I have no idea. You're directly in the line of fire for foul balls that come straight back.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking a dozen a game at least, if not two dozen a game. And that was my first introduction from the Midwest. I'd never heard of carpenter bees before, but it was my first introduction to carpenter bees, especially early in the season. So, you know, when it's warm in April, they would bore holes in anything they could get their teeth into and buzz right in front of your face. Now, my favorite story about that press box, and Dan Collins, a longtime beat writer for the Winston-Salem Journal, he didn't just cover Wake Forest sports, but he covered the Winston-Salem professional baseball team, the Warthogs at the time. He told me this story of when he had first started, the windows had chicken wire on them. So it very much seemed like a chicken coop, by the way. So they had chicken wire over the facing to protect people from foul balls. Dan and the guy who ran the scoreboard, I believe, either PA announcer or scoreboard, got tired of looking through the chicken wire because it would blur your vision, give them headaches. So they decided, just kind of on their own one night, that they're going to take down the chicken wire. Whether they needed wire cutters to do this or not, I'm not sure. Well, as they're hatching their plan to take down the chicken wire, the guy who played the organ overheard them. He had a keen sense of hearing, as you can imagine, because he was the organ player. And also the fact that they're only separated by a thin plywood wall. And he said, wait a second, you guys are taking down the chicken wire. Yeah, we're going to take down the chicken wire. We're tired of looking at it. And he said, well, I am too. And they said, we're not sure you should take yours down. You know, it could be dangerous. He insisted that if they're going to take theirs down, he was going to take his down, even though they're in the line of fire.
I like it.
Now, Dan and the other guy figured they could defend themselves, but the organ player was blind.
Oh.
But yet he still insisted on taking down his chicken wire. As far as I know, he didn't take one to the temple. I don't know why he would have been bothered by the chicken wire. Obviously, it wouldn't have messed up his vision any more than it already was. In my 3 years of calling a game there, I only caught one foul ball, and it came to my right hand with my pin in my hand.
Yeah.
And I managed to catch. I became a pro at diving out of the way. Discretion is a better form of valor when it comes to foul balls with exit velocity north of 100.
Yeah.
Can I tell you, would you mind if I share my second favorite press box story?
Does it involve a person named Eric?
It does.
Sure, go for it. I don't know if the listeners know about the pilot episode. I believe we talked about backgrounds, and I don't know if that ever aired. We got to blow the dust off. And
we're gonna blow the dust off. I was in charge. And not just calling the games, but I was in charge of media relations for the Winston-Salem Warthogs, and the press box employees were under my purview. Yep. So being brand new to the city, the town, I had to hire official scorers, which is a thankless job to say the least. But it's also hard to find anybody qualified to do it. Given a couple of names from the year prior, and some people were available and some weren't, and I got hold of Chris Capo, who was the sports information director at Wake Forest. And that's a friendship to continues to this day. He's my spotter for my college football. And I got Chris to come over and do some games when he was available. I got your brother to come over and do some games. And this was 99 or 2000. So you are how old at the time?
I would have been, let's call it 17, 18.
Okay, so you're a teenager.
I'm a teenager.
You're a teenager. You were still in high school at the time, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Which were the best 6 years of my life, by the way.
So you're like a senior in high school, maybe a junior. You come over, and I think Michael couldn't make a game. He had something going on, but hey, my brother could do it. And I talked to you a little bit about it. And you knew how to score a game, which was a victory in and of itself. There was computer program. Did you do the computer program, or did I have to enter it after the fact?
I did the automated scorebook.
The automated scorebook.
Yep.
Yeah. My predecessor, Tim Grubbs, would do the automated scorebook while he called the game.
Ooh.
Which I thought, you know, hey, listen, I'm paying these yahoos to do it. They can do the whole job.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Warthogs were the White Sox affiliate. And they had a left-hander by the name of Eric Fisher. I just pulled up his baseball reference page, so I want to get the facts right.
Yeah.
Eric was a seventh-round pick the year prior. So seventh-round pick in 98
from
at
Cincinnati?
Archbishop Moeller High School in Cincinnati. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Archbishop Moeller is a famous high school, especially on the prep football scene. Anthony Munoz played there, amongst others. His son, who went on to play at Tennessee. I don't think... the Larkin brothers played there, Barry and Byron. I don't think Ken Griffey played there, but I'll just throw that name out there. He may have.
Yeah.
So Eric was 20 years old in 2000. So he was just barely older. So this was 2000. Okay,
yeah.
So let me correct it. This was 2000. He was just barely older than my official score for this given game. This was a season where Fisher would finish the year 4-9 with an ERA. Let me see if you want to play this game. Over or under ERA of 5?
I would have taken the over on 4. I'm not sure if I'm taking the over on 5, but for the fun of it, I'm going over.
You'd be right. He finished the season with 12 starts and 25 appearances. As I mentioned, a record of 4 wins, 9 losses, an ERA of 7.23.
It would have been a right at 7 if it weren't for me.
Probably would have. His strikeout to walk ratio was just about 1-1. His whip was 1.823, and he allowed nearly 12 hits per 9 innings. So... Eric wasn't necessarily living up to the hype of a seventh-round pick. The bonus he used to buy a fancy red sports car, I believe it was a Dodge Stealth.
I got BMW convertible.
You think it was a BMW convertible?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to tell the full story with the back-end damage, I believe it was a BMW.
Okay. Well, I'll let you finish the back-end. So anyway, on this particular night, I don't remember the particulars of his outing, except that it was short and there was inconsistent defense behind him.
It got late early for Mr. Fisher in the world.
It did get late early. By the way, in 25 appearances, he only threw 69 innings. So
nice.
That was not uncommon. You made a scoring decision, which he disagreed with.
Mm-hmm.
And the year 2000 would not have been Wally Backman's year. I think Wally Backman was a manager in 01. Does that sound right?
Sounds right.
Brian Daubach, Jerry Terrell would have been 99 in 2000, and then Wally came in. It was not uncommon for Wally to approach the official score after the game, a few glasses of scotch.
Passionately.
By glasses, I mean plastic cups. Yes, screaming, yelling, cursing. It made the Washington Post one time, made me very uncomfortable. That's a whole nother story. Anyway, but it was uncouth for a player to do so. If you had a problem, there's a process to go through. Eric had a problem, and so he decided to find his way to the press box, which was
not hard to do.
You don't know any better. How the hell do you get up there, right? It'd be easier jumping in a hot air balloon. Anyway, the game is over. He is in street clothes. The game has just ended. There's a pounding on the door. And I take off my headset, leave my three listeners in the lurch, and I go address the situation. And he is furious, and he wants to talk to the GD official score who doesn't know S and WTF and blah, 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 blah. Now, a lot of times official scoring decisions can be 50-50. I don't remember the particulars of this one. Mm-mm. I don't know if he had a case or not. All I knew is that if he laid eyes on you and realized that the official scorer was younger than him, we would have had a problem, not just with Eric Fisher, the entire clubhouse, and maybe as high as Kenny Williams and Jerry Reinsdorf within the White Sox organization.
Yep.
So I was able to cut him off. I told him to shut up, get the hell out of there, and go back to the clubhouse. Yada, yada, we avoided near catastrophe. But I don't remember the – did you – what, did you rear-end his car after that?
No, no. I remember two parts you left out there. He slammed the door on the way out. And
we're lucky the whole thing didn't fall down the net.
That was the scariest part of my teenage years, was when that door slammed. I thought we were going over. I thought we were done. Because if there was any structural integrity, it was eroded by the entomology report that could have been done with the numerous different critters.
I forgot about the ants.
The ants were prevalent.
Yeah. And the structural integrity of my grandma's meatloaf.
Yeah. And so he slams the door, and you know that happens, and I don't remember much after that. But I do remember a few days later, y'all go on a road trip. And back then, everyone would park in the parking lot over at the corner of Deacon Boulevard and Shore Fair there, and get on the bus and go. Walk up the hill from the clubhouse, if you want to call it a clubhouse, and get on the bus and go. Well, like, three cars got keyed during that road trip, and by far, the worst one was Eric Fisher. And so, I don't know, you got on the rotary phone back then, and you called me, and you're like, hey, brother, like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you did do something, you know, I'll keep it between us, but, I mean, you didn't do anything, did you? I'm like, no, of course I didn't, but that's outstanding. And so, yeah, that was Eric Fisher meets a 17, 18-year-old official scorer and a wet cardboard box. So,
yeah,
good stuff. Hit Bull Win Podcast. We'll be back after this. All right, we'll speed up in your career development here. You go to Tennessee after Winston with the Smokies, and if I'm not mistaken, you're at that point is kind of when you started to do some more than just minor league baseball stuff, and you were balancing the two. I remember running over to Zebulon and actually meeting you over there for a game. I don't know if you had a backup guy, but you definitely left the press box and just came down the left field line and hung out for a couple innings, which to this day, I'm like, I don't know who's calling the game right now. But, you know, whatever. So what – talk to us about that next step. How did you get the break into ESPN and being on our TVs for no offense to the Winston Warthogs in the Carolina League, but some more marquee sporting events?
I got to know a guy by the name of Carter Blackburn while I was working in Winston-Salem. And Carter was a Syracuse guy. Carter was very well connected. He, like, I don't want to say well connected, like that's a reason why he made progress in his career. He's very talented, but he was also refined, where I was not. And so he knew what steps he needed to take, and I had no clue what steps I needed to take. So I would bend Carter's ear a little bit here and there. And Carter had left the company that I was doing freelance work for, ISP, which then begat IMG, begat this, that it's hard to keep up with these days. Yeah. But he left there to go do television work for a network called College Sports Television. And he calls me up one day, or maybe we went to lunch, and he said, "Hey man, you can either check out this network. It's based in New York City. They've got a bunch of events, obviously college stuff. I can put you in touch with one of the guys if you want to." So I said, sure. So I call up their talent director, who was a guy who was a few years younger than me at the time by the name of Gideon Cohen. Gideon is my agent to this day. But at the time, he was working for College Sports Television. And based in New York City and dealing with college sports, despite the fact that Gideon went to Syracuse, they really had no idea the landscape of college sports, as shocking as that may sound, to the extent that when they had a swimming and diving event at the University of Georgia, Gideon called and he said, "Oh, yeah, that's not that far, right?" I said, "Sure. Yeah, no, that's nothing." Lo and behold, you know, like it's not, I mean, it's closer than New York City, but it's not right around the corner. So that's how some of these early assignments went. They had plenty of people that lived and worked in and around New York City that we did games with or worked with. Boog Shambi was there. Scott Zolak, the former Patriots quarterback, did some games for him. Michelle Beadle. Greg Amzinger's on MLB Network. Adam Zucker's on CBS. So Michelle Beadle, I don't know if I mentioned her. So anyway, they had all this talent. They just didn't have anybody in the woods. Well, I was in the woods, so they used me for a couple of college events. And then I had the opportunity to do more events during the spring and summer months, spring mainly, whether that was college softball, doing games. You know, and the rights that they had were pretty random. They had some Stanford baseball and softball. I guess technically it was Pac-12, but they happened to always go to Stanford. Mm-hmm. They had some Notre Dame baseball and softball. They had these random swimming and diving events. I did the NAIA National Championship football game from West Tennessee and did the sidelines for that one. So anyway, I got involved with that network and I just kind of did more and more until finally we got to the point where I was flying back on a red eye from Palo Alto or from SFO to Atlanta, connecting to get to Knoxville or connecting to get to Huntsville or connecting to get to wherever, so I could rush to go do a minor league game on the radio on a Monday night with 200 people in the crowd. And it just, the rate of return was diminishing, to say the least. So I finally made the decision after 9 years calling minor league baseball and the last few mixing in some TV work. I got enough TV work where I thought there was a future at it and got a contract. So I was able to say goodbye to minor league baseball and then go full time into the TV world.
Cool. I think what a lot of listeners will probably recognize their introduction to you with your time with Fox Sports South and the Braves. We'll get to one part of that which ties directly back to the Bulls at some point. But so what was it like to be the GM of the Atlanta Braves?
Well, when I got offered the job, I was honored. First of all, the Braves were a lot of fun, but you mentioned the GM, you know, of course, when I started, well, John Scherholz was the president, but and John Scherholz to me represented the Braves. I mean, there was Hank Aaron, Chipper Jones, John Scherholz, Bobby Cox, like to me, and of course the big three. But I grew up a Kansas City Royals fan and he was the GM of the team in 1985 that won the World Series. So, and he always carried himself with his class and dignity. To me, that was, you know, he was the head of this entire organization. I only say that as an introduction because the biggest compliment that I ever got came from John Scherholz, and it was a direct reflection of all the time I spent in minor league baseball. Mm-hmm. My favorite thing to do in minor league baseball was to go down to the bullpen either before or during batting practice and stand there with the pitching coach and watch guys throw. And it could be a nobody. I remember we had this guy in Winston-Salem named Kyle Kane, who was a relatively high draft pick. And he got on the rubber for his first bullpen session with Juan Nieves, who's since spent a lot of time in the big leagues as a pitching coach. And he starts throwing and he stops. There's two guys on each rubber throwing and Juan's watching both of them. And he stopped and he looked to Juan and he says, "I have a question. I said, yeah, what do you need? And he goes, I'm thinking he's going to ask about grip. Or he goes, which side of the rubber should I stand on? Mm. And Juan looked at him, goes, you know, and to me, I was like, this guy's in pro ball and he doesn't know where to stand. That was my naivety. But Juan, being a great teacher, just looked at him and said, well, what side do you like to stand on? Yeah. He said, well, I like to stand on the third base side. He goes, well, then stand on the third base side. He said, tell you what, why don't you throw 10 from the third base side, slide over the first base side, throw another 10, and then throw 10 from the middle. And I thought, you know, it's something so simple, but what a way to teach the game. Anyway, when you live it every day, as you know, and as fans of this podcast know, it becomes routine and it becomes part of your life. So fast forward years later, I'd been out of minor league baseball for a few years. I get the job with Fox Sports South to be the sideline reporter for the Braves. And in the first month, I had very limited interaction with John Schuerholz. And finally, they announced that John Smoltz is going into the Braves Hall of Fame, and I'm going to interview Schuerholz for the pregame show, which was, as I mentioned, a rarity. And we're going to talk about Smoltz, essentially. So I conduct the interview in the dugout, right at the front end of a batting practice. He leaves, goes to the cage, and he and the media relations director kind of keep looking back over to the dugout. And I know that look because I got it enough from my various principals in school who were talking to the teacher. Like, they're talking about me, and it's probably not good. And finally, the PR guy comes back over, and we're just making small talk. And I go, hey, man, did I do something wrong? Did I upset Mr. Schuerholz? He goes, no. No, on the contrary. He goes, I actually was coming over. He goes, I don't know you that well. He goes, I got a weird question. If you're not busy, can Mr. Schuerholz come back over? And I was like, yeah, sure. Like, it's his ballpark. What do you mean? So anyway, John Schuerholz comes back over, and he just kind of wants to make small talk. And he says, Tom, what's your background? Where did you play? And I said, oh, I didn't play. I mean, you count like a year of JV in high school. I did not play. Blah, blah, blah. I went to the University of Missouri. Was a Royals fan, by the way, when you were with the club. This and that. And he goes, no, you had to have played. I said, believe me, I tell you this, I did. He goes, well, you talk the game so well. Why and how do you know the game so well? I said, well, Mr. Schuerholz, I spent 9 years in the minor leagues. I spent 9 years riding buses. I spent 9 years watching bullpen sessions. I spent 9 years going and having beers with the coaching staff on a Wednesday night, you know, in Huntsville. That's my background. That's how I learned the game. And even though I was a fan on the front end, I was a very casual fan, you know, and so I didn't learn it until I lived it. And for John Schuerholz to say, I can talk the game, like, that was a huge compliment, because I had to learn how to talk the game. I made a lot of mistakes early on. But like I said at the beginning, as long as you have time to correct those mistakes, then that's fine.
Yep. Yep. One of your favorite Braves moments that we don't have time to go fully into, but I advise any baseball fan, and I mean just any fan of life, especially, you know, a Durham Bulls fan and Elliot Johnson fan, is to Google Elliot Johnson interviews. And there's two.
If you're a good editor, you could probably just splice it into this.
That's
podcast.
A good point. Which I'm not. I'm not even a bad editor. Just whatever below that. That's what I'm pegging for right here. But two great interviews of Elliot's short time in Atlanta. One where he morphs into Harry Carey, and then one where he just randomly decides to be a NASCAR driver, which is, I think that one got the most attention. But I remember I was pulling into Winston to get a haircut, and you called me like the day after Elliot signed. You're like, so what kind of guy are we getting here? It's like, yeah, you know, you'll have a good bit of fun with him. Like, he'll be able to go back and forth with you. Had no idea that those two interviews would be able to be pulled off. Those were awesome. But kind of last question here, as we get to present day.
Can I tell one story about Elliot Johnson?
Yeah, go for it. So all we got is time.
Okay, good. As you're explaining that, all I think about, like, when I my recollection is he has such an incredible sense of humor and timing, and and nerve, really. Like, you know, the nerve to take over a post-game interview standing on Turner Fields, you know, basically at home plate with however many tens of thousands of people in that building, and to pull it off. But I remember back to the Harry Carey impersonation. We did that in St. Louis, and it came up in casual conversation. He had done it a couple times, I think, on the Fox national broadcast. I convinced him to do it for our interview, and we're in the locker room, and he's like, "Yeah, hey, let's go outside and do it." I was like, "Okay, I mean, like, we can do it right here. We get my camera guys right here. Nah, let's go out to the dugout. Not too many guys around." And the one thing Major League Baseball gets wrong, and I've talked to a lot of guys about this who played, and to a man, many people have said to me, "Man, I wish I had more fun while I was playing. I wish I understood that the game could be fun." But and this goes from Chris Burke's Houston Astros teams, the Phillies of the early 90s who played for, you know, the Blue Jays in the World Championship, where people thought that because the veterans set a certain tone that I have to be dead serious about everything, that I can't smile and I can't have fun, at least publicly or at least to the media. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a shame that is, because it should be a fun game. And I understand that there are pressures involved with it, and I understand that there are contracts that take the fun out of it and the business takes the fun out of it. But if Elliot Johnson can't do his Harry Carey in the clubhouse where other guys would get a kick out of it, but he's afraid that and I didn't never asked him about this, and maybe I'm totally wrong here. But if he's afraid that he's going to get looked down upon or judged, or somebody on the coaching staff is going to think, well, he doesn't take the game seriously enough because he's willing to show personality, mm-hmm. then, you know, something's wrong with the game.
Yeah.
And so it's sad that that's the first thing that comes to mind, but I'm like, man, that would have been so much funnier with more people involved. And I tried to bring personality out and have fun, but there were certain guys who were just reluctant to do so, even though I knew that they were like side-splitting funny and fans would love to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of that from what I've seen here, you know, that can go a lot to it. Even if it's the same coaching staff year over year, for whatever reason, that clubhouse establishes some type of culture, right? And sometimes that's acceptable, sometimes it's not. But by and large, the years in which that's acceptable, those are the most enjoyable. And usually those are the ones that are winning the most too. EJ's interviews, give him a shout on Google. You'll or YouTube, you'll enjoy it. But all right, so our last bit here. What with COVID-19 and at least at the MLB level, where you see these, the laundry list of rules and regulations of what's going to fly and what's not going to fly. Some teams I saw, I don't remember what team it was I saw today, said they are not going to send their radio guys on the road, even though they're allowed to. What from a listener and viewer standpoint, what's going to be some of the biggest hurdles that we're going to have to be okay with not, you know, clearing in 2020, assuming these sports are able to come back? How's the telecast going to change?
From a home viewer standpoint, I'm trying to imagine some of the issues. I'm not sure that the average fan is going to notice a lot of these changes. And let me preface my answer with this. I don't want to hear any broadcaster complaining about the hurdles that they have to clear to do their job the way they're used to doing it. I know a lot of these men and women are perfectionists and they want the best working conditions possible. We all do for any job that we do, whether that's broadcasting or farming. You're getting the field ready, by the way. You want the weather to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Sometimes you're going to get 3 straight rainouts, or sometimes you're going to have an activity on your field for 40 straight days. It's just the way it is. Deal with it. I think that the danger of not having any baseball or any college football is so great, and this situation is so tenuous. We have to appreciate what we get, and nobody really cares if your job is a little bit harder. We have, what, as of today, 130,000 people have passed away. 40, 50, 60 million people are out of work totally. So deal with it. Mm-hmm. As far as the viewers, the biggest challenge for broadcasters that when you try to hide any of these issues from the viewers at home, I see two issues. Number one, when you're doing a remote broadcast, when you are away from the game, and you're essentially, a lot of these people might be in an empty stadium at home. They might be in a broom closet at their local studio. There's every situation probably be different. It's hard then to have that same energy when you're removed from the stadium. When you're at the stadium, whether it's SEC football game on a Saturday night, at LSU, or up the road here at Truist Park, the new name of the Braves Stadium. You know, when you're in the building and your emotions and your energy rise and fall with that of the crowd. So in that regard, a lot of these games are going to feel like you've already had a 3-hour rain delay. It's 1 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday night in Philadelphia, and you're not really sure who's listening and when is that 27th out going to be here. So that's going to be a challenge to keep the energy up. It's you're really going to appreciate those broadcasting crews who have great camaraderie, because when you have a great partner, you can feed off of their energy and vice versa. You can help each other along. You can carry them, so to speak, and they can carry you. The other thing that would be an issue for me, and this is not an issue for all broadcasters. There are some guys out there who just do their broadcast. I call them media guide readers. You know, they're just going to find the bio and they're going to read it, and they're going to spit out facts that are not really germane to that game as a whole or those storylines, but just to that one player. I was always proud when I was doing the Brave stuff of finding stories that were of interest by digging a little deeper, asking more questions. And those conversations, they can happen in a formal scenario, in the clubhouse before the game, on the bench, during batting practice, around the cage, or they can happen in a very informal setting. On the flight to the West Coast, on the bus ride back to the hotel, at the hotel bar, you run into a guy. I remember when Chipper Jones came off the disabled list. It was in Houston. This is his final year. Came off the DL in Houston, and I am in essentially a food court. I remember the sandwich shop, although the name escapes me right now. And Chipper walks in with his parents. Like, there's Chipper Jones eating a ham and cheese, at this random restaurant. And a brief conversation there can turn into a great nugget and storyline and something that could not only cover an at-bat, but an entire inning. And so the broadcasters won't have the opportunity for those type of interactions that lead to nuggets, that lead to great stories. And I think fans will miss out on that, because it'll be a lot less about, here's what player A is thinking today. Here's a conversation we had with the manager. Here's what was discussed off the record over a glass of Pinot Noir last night. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff won't happen. And so it'll be a challenge for all of the broadcasters and producers to try and find that stuff to keep the broadcast as entertaining as they normally are.
Tom, thank you for your time. I think you got a great story with starting a career out in minor league baseball, beating the door down, hopefully not literally at the Ernie Shore Field press box door. But I think our listeners will thoroughly appreciate a little more background on you and some nuggets now to talk about when they're listening to you call a big SEC matchup this fall, or anything else that pops up in the future. So thanks again for your time. We appreciate you joining us.
What is my parting gift? Because last time I was at the ballpark, Danny Cannell left with like fistfuls of gear, and I had to steal the mascot's magnetized hat.
Yeah, you did get to wear the hat, but if my dad were here, he would tell you the check's in the mail, buddy. So,
yeah. Well, I still have a HGS tan jacket deep in the closet, so I'm gonna rip that baby out and pretend like I'm a big deal. Thanks for having me. That was awesome. A fun trip down memory lane.
Awesome. Thank you again, sir. All right, Bulls fans, that was Tom Hart, former voice of the Winston Warthogs, Tennessee Smokies, current ESPN play-by-play personality. Does a lot of games on SEC Network, like we talked about for football season and during basketball season as well. So big thanks to Tom, great old friend, for coming on the podcast. I hope everyone enjoyed it. And we hope to bring you more similar interesting content in the future. Once again, thanks for listening to Hit Bull Win Podcast.